This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier today, President Bush publicly endorsed a constitutional amendment to define marriage as the union of a man and a woman as husband and wife. In a brief statement from the Roosevelt Room of the White House, the president said he was alarmed by what's been happening in Massachusetts courts and at San Francisco's City Hall. Activists, judges, and local officials, he said, are trying to redefine a basic social institution, and he worried that the Federal Defense of Marriage Act may not hold up to the challenge. For these reasons, he said, the defense of marriage requires a constitutional amendment. Here's a portion of what he had to say.
An amendment to the Constitution is never to be undertaken lightly. The amendment process has addressed many serious matters of national concern, and the preservation of marriage rises to this level of national importance. The union of a man and woman is the most enduring human institution, honored and encouraged in all cultures and by every religious faith. Ages of experience have taught humanity that the commitment of a husband and wife to love and to serve one another promotes the welfare of children and the stability of society. Marriage cannot be severed from its cultural, religious, and natural roots without weakening the good influence of society. Government, by recognizing and protecting marriage, serves the interests of all. Today, I call upon the Congress to promptly pass and to send to the states for ratification an amendment to our Constitution defining and protecting marriage as the union of a man and woman as husband and wife. The amendment should fully protect marriage while leaving the state legislatures free to make their own choices in defining legal arrangements other than marriage. America is a free society, which limits the role of government in the lives of our citizens. This commitment of freedom, however, does not require the redefinition of one of our most basic social institutions. Our government should respect every person and protect the institution of marriage. There is no contradiction between these responsibilities.
While some conservative groups and politicians have long called for just such an amendment, the president's endorsement today takes the debate to an entirely different level. We're going to talk about politics. It will have escaped no one's attention that this is an election year. And about process. How are amendments proposed? Who gets to vote? How are they approved or defeated? We'll also speak with constitutional scholars about the arguments we're likely to hear and about whether the president's statement shifts this debate from for or against gay marriage to a discussion of the Constitution. Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Bob Benenson, the politics editor of Congressional Quarterly. He joins us from his home here in Washington, D.C. Good of you to be with us.
Yeah, thanks, Neil.
The president says you do not try to amend the Constitution lightly, and of course he's right about that. Of course, another thing that's never taken lightly around the White House is timing. Why this announcement now?
Well, you know, we are in the middle of a political season. The president, it's always a dangerous thing to arrogate to yourself to get inside the minds of politicians and why they do things. President Bush has consistently been a social conservative. Social conservatives, religious conservatives are the bedrock of his political base. So there's nothing inconsistent about what he's doing. But it's also the timing contemporaneously with the president coming out and as a candidate and putting aside his role as the head of state and actually getting on the campaign trail, mm-hmm. which he's been doing. The fact that a good part of his conservative base has been grumbling lately, you know, the president still has amazing support amongst his base Republican voters, you know, more than 90% of the polls, but there's been some unhappiness there, not only about the budget deficit, but about the Medicare prescription drug benefit plan, which some conservatives feel is a big new entitlement program, which they're unhappy about. And some conservatives were unhappy that the president didn't take a stronger stand on gay marriage. So when you know, it's an important one of the important things when going into a close election, and as this one appears it's going to be, is make sure that your base is motivated. Make sure you can energize those, you know, the liberals on the Democratic side, the conservatives on the Republican side, and by all means, don't unmotivate them. And you know, if there was a concern around the White House that the base conservative voters were starting to think, well, maybe we're not as excited about George W. Bush as we've been over the past 3 years, then they felt like they needed to address this as soon as possible. But of course, you know, the timing has also been influenced by outside events. The Massachusetts court decision that mandated the legalization of gay marriage in Massachusetts, and the events in San Francisco of late.
Mm-hmm. Now, in his announcement, he used the term activist court, activist judges a lot. Why did he, do you think, included that language?
Because that's a topic of conversation that's consistently used among conservatives. There's a perception that the courts are dominated by liberals, and liberal judges are acting as lawmakers. It's a point that is greatly argued. It's being argued in the context of President Bush nominating and using recess appointments recently to put highly conservative, ideologically conservative judges on the court, and whether their intentions are to pass laws from the bench. But the idea that we need to have a national force come in and stop these liberal judges from passing laws from the bench has been a consistent theme on the conservative side of the spectrum for years, going back to the Warren Court 50 years ago.
By making this announcement, does the president put Democrats, and more specifically Senators Kerry and Edwards, on the defensive?
Well, there are a lot of Republican strategists who certainly hope that's the case. It depends on where the public comes down on this kind of thing. And one of the interesting things, going back to your original question about a statement that the president said we don't change the Constitution lightly. Well, that's for sure. And there have been a whole bunch of propositions over the years that have a great deal of popular support in theory. Flag burning. If you ask people, should burning the American flag be illegal, I think you'd probably get 95% of support in a public opinion poll. But a constitutional amendment has come up dozens of times over the past 10, 15 years in Congress and never gotten through because the public does not take lightly the idea, and they don't, and they want, and it has to be something absolutely essential to the nature of the country that can't be dealt with by the legislatures and can't be dealt by the courts to change the Constitution. And so even though, and we've seen this dichotomy in some public opinion polls already, where people are asked, do you oppose gay marriage? 2-1. The public, you know, the respondents say yes. Do you favor a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage? And the numbers are almost opposite. They say no. So there's where, will the Democrats be on the defensive on this? We don't know yet. We don't know how high a priority an issue this is going to be to the average voter, because we've got a year where economic issues are big. We've got a big foreign policy problem overseas.
And we'll be talking more about the public opinion aspect of this a little bit later. But let's talk politics for just a moment. Where is this battle likely to be fought? One of the interesting things about the constitutional amendment process is that the president doesn't really have a role.
No, he doesn't. And it's going to be fought in Congress. And then this also, you know, is relevant to, you know, what we were just discussing. Is this going to be a high priority mm-hmm. for Congress in this this election year? And it's a short election year, a short legislating year, I should say, because the members of Congress are going to be spending a lot of time at home campaigning. Their recesses are long and frequent, and they've got a lot of other things, including a big, messy budget fight, and including overseeing what the situation is in Iraq to deal with. We've got a multiplicity of independent commissions and congressional investigatory panels looking into things like why 9/11 happened, the lead up to the Iraq war was. Is this a fight that Congress is going to want to pick, or did the president throw this out there and say, okay, I'm on your side, people who oppose gay marriage, with the knowledge that this is probably not going to go very far?
So he may want the issue more than he wants the amendment.
Well, the degree to that he wants the amendment, it's probably not going to go very far this year. There are enough Democratic votes to keep the amendment from passing by the majorities that are needed in Congress, unless, you know, public opinion scares Democrats into thinking that they have to support it, which is doubtful.
It has to pass by a two-thirds majority in both the House of Representatives and in the United States Senate, which is not easy. I'm not sure you could get a mom and apple pie resolution with a two-thirds majority through either house of either chamber of the House at this point.
I agree, Neil, and you've got a 51-49 essentially Republican majority in the Senate, which is far short, 16 votes short of that two-thirds. And there are some Republicans who might not support this measure because they are from states that have substantial gay constituencies and liberal and moderate swing voters who are essential to their electoral outcomes.
We've gotten some reaction already, of course. Terry McAuliffe, speaking for the Democratic Party, says the Democratic Party is opposed to a constitutional amendment. Where do the two major candidates at this point, Senators Kerry and Edwards, stand on this issue?
John Kerry has said that he's in an interesting position because he said he is opposes gay marriage, but he has in the past opposed the idea of a constitutional amendment to ban it because he sees it as the traditional camel's nose under the tent. It's an issue that an ideological wing of our political spectrum would like to use to gain a big victory, and that it will lead to other efforts along the lines of their agenda, such as their opposition to abortion and so on down the line.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Kerry has said that he supports civil unions. I believe that Senator Edwards has come down in the same direction. I'm not sure if I've heard him come out and say expressly where he stands on a constitutional amendment on gay marriage, but it would be surprising, you know, given the substantial support that Democrat candidates tend to get from gay activists if he would come down in support of the president's position. So, you know, obviously it's an issue that either Kerry or Edwards would have to approach with some trepidation if the Democratic strategy is to win some swing states and the border south that they lost last time, that could have tipped the election. For instance, West Virginia or Tennessee, mm-hmm. Kentucky, Louisiana, Arkansas, Florida, where they might have a fighting chance, but where the Republicans would hit them heavily on this issue.
Briefly, you've said you know, there's not likely to be a chance of passage in Congress this year. At the same time, there are already 38 states that have various types of one man, one woman as a definition of marriage laws on the book. So if this did get out of Congress, might it have better reception in the states?
It might. It depends on the wording of it. It depends on the position whether this is a state issue that the federal government shouldn't have a say in. I mean, the states' rights issue is always one that both parties use it at their own convenience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if the Democrats, if states have stronger product liability laws, then the Democrats want to leave it up to the states and not have a federal standard. The Republicans, in this case, they say that states' rights.
Bob Benenson, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, you're welcome, Neil.
Bob Benenson of Congressional Quarterly, Congressional Constitutional Scholars. After a break, it's NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about President Bush's endorsement today of an amendment to the Constitution to define marriage as between a man and a woman as husband and wife. President Bush threw his support behind the idea after hesitating for some years. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can email us, TOTN at npr.org. This could set the stage for congressional and legislative actions. The process could get bogged down at any point along the way, so we've asked two constitutional law experts to help us understand the legal labyrinth that may lie ahead and talk to us a little bit about the history of amendments. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Jeffrey Rosen, an associate professor at George Washington University Law School, legal affairs editor at the New Republic magazine. It's good to have you with us today.
Very good to be here.
And with us from his office in Malibu, California, is Douglas Kamek, professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University, co-author most recently of Individual Rights and the American Constitution. And it's good to have you back on the program as well, Doug.
Neil and Jeffrey, good to be with you both.
Okay. To begin with, in his announcement, the president asked Congress to take up his request. Jeffrey, what happens now?
I guess it can or it can't, and each house has to decide on its own whether or not to propose the amendment. They'll need a two-thirds vote, and as you were just discussing, it would be hard to get for various reasons. And then a choice is faced. If, by chance, the amendment gets two-thirds of both houses of Congress, it can direct that ratification either be by three-fourths of the state legislatures or by three-fourths of specially held conventions called in the states. But the idea of ratification by convention has only taken place once for the repeal of the Prohibition Amendment, so generally we could expect that if it is passed by Congress, it would go to the states for ratification.
Doug Kamek, if Congress does, both houses by two-thirds majority, does approve this this amendment, and we have yet to see language, and they both have to agree on the same language, it then does not go to the president at all.
It does not. It becomes effective at the moment that the 38th state ratifies.
And so the president's role in this is other than the bully pulpit, whether he may be for or against it, that's all it is.
Well, that's right. And presidents historically have sometimes been detached from these amendments and sometimes have made it the centerpiece of their politics. You'll remember that in the Reagan administration, President Reagan called for a balanced budget amendment and urged the states to petition the Congress for a constitutional amendment, and also actively supported such an amendment within the Congress itself, but in both instances, neither the states were successful in calling for the amendment, nor was the Congress.
Jeffrey Rosen, is the proposed amendment subject to judicial review? Could the Supreme Court say, it's all very well and good for you guys to debate this, or even the legislatures to pass it, but it doesn't pass constitutional muster?
No, although the idea of an unconstitutional amendment is something I have interest in, because as a law student, I imagined a crazy possibility of an amendment that presumed to repeal the First Amendment. And if you believe that there are natural rights to speech, maybe it wouldn't be valid. But that's a crazy view that only law students have. Essentially, the Supreme Court's only role would be in deciding what exactly the amendment required. And there is some question about whether the amendment currently pending, proposed by Representative Musgrave, would or would not allow for civil unions to be decided in each state. And the language is sufficiently ambiguous that the court might decide that it does not allow for civil unions, which some of its proponents wish and some don't, and therefore that could get tangled up in court in an important way. The question of whether you should have an amendment that's clear enough so that it doesn't require much judicial review is one that will no doubt be debated, and presumably there will be attempts to come up with clearer, more narrow amendments in the weeks and days ahead.
And obviously, we haven't seen language yet. There are bills that are being proposed, certainly in the House of Representatives, but it's not clear yet what language. And Doug Kamek, it certainly does matter what the language is.
Well, it does, because as Jeffrey suggested, there is a battle line even among the strong supporters of the amendment as to whether it should cover not just the formal title of marriage, but also the legal incidence thereof. Congressman Musgrave's proposal uses that language, and she has said, I believe, and others supporting it have said, it's not meant to preclude the states from granting rights of civil union, but there is obviously some dispute over that.
We have an email question on exactly that point. I'd like to know what this amendment is going to say. Is there a written version of it yet, and is there any way to get a copy? Are you familiar with the proposed legislation, Jeffrey?
I think that I have the text here, and the first sentence defines marriage in the United States shall consist only of the union of a man and a woman, and that's the first section. But the second section is the more controversial part. In the Musgrave Amendment, it goes on to say that neither this Constitution or the Constitution of any state, nor state or federal law, shall be construed to require that marital status or the legal incidence thereof be conferred upon unmarried couples or groups, and the dispute that Doug Kamek was just referring to is whether that crucial language about law being construed to confer the incidence of marriage on unmarried couples or groups would preempt domestic partnership laws of Vermont, California, New Jersey, and Hawaii, which essentially require civil unions, which are the convey the legal incidence of marriage, to be conveyed on same-sex couples. It is frustrating to people who are trying to carve out a moderate middle position on this, to say civil union should be decided in the states, but marriage is between a man and a woman, that you could have an amendment where the sponsor says, I want to allow civil unions, but the language, at least as I read it, could plausibly be construed to mean the opposite. And that's in some ways the most interesting part of the next phase of the debate, I think.
And again, there's nothing to stipulate that that is going to be the language of a proposed amendment, though it has been proposed in the House of Representatives. It's running into some considerable difficulty in the Senate.
But it's very important to get the understanding of that language correct, not only because we owe it as a matter of accountability to the people who will be voting on it, but also because as a political matter, the ambiguities of language can defeat an amendment. You may remember, Neil, that back in the 1970s, there was an effort to add an equal rights amendment to the Constitution. And it was largely over disputes about the meaning of the language that Congress had employed that in many ways defeated that amendment, because some argued that it was an implicit authorization of a broader right to abortion, for example, than even the Supreme Court had approved.
Let's get some callers involved, and if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We'll begin with Adam, who's with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask about some of your guests' opinions about the history of amendments being introduced. You just brought up the Equal Rights Amendment, but historically, amendments have been brought up usually to grant rights to citizens, the Bill of Rights, the Equal Rights Amendment. There are only a few that have been brought up to restrict rights rather than tweaking laws to perfect them. Prohibition, for example, was brought up earlier, but it was turned around just a few years later because it was a mistake. So I'm wondering if anyone has any comments about the role of amendments in terms of what types they are. Are they granting rights, taking the rights away, or just correcting laws in the past?
More than just a few years later if you were living through the 1920s. But anyway, Jeffrey Rosen?
Well, it's a complicated question because, of course, one person's grant of rights is another person's restriction of rights. And the marriage debate is so complicated that the question of whether you see it as granting or restricting probably comes down to what side of it you're on as well. I suppose the closest analog to this marriage amendment, I gather that there were in the 19th century some amendments proposed to give Congress the power to regulate marriage so that polygamy could be banned, because there was some question about the status of that. And state constitutional provisions banning polygamy were a requirement for the admission of certain states into the Union. And the status of polygamy now is contested in light of these recent decisions. So there have been analogs to this. Of course, recently we've seen abortion amendments and prayer amendments and plenty of those proposed in the wake of the Warren and Berger and Rehnquist court decisions. So I suppose the simplest thing to say is that amendments are proposed about issues that people feel very firmly about, and they pass when there's a tremendous national consensus about them.
Doug Kamek, I think one of the things Adam is talking about is also efforts to pass this kinds of constitutional amendment on issues of morality. Certainly a prohibition was seen in that light.
It was, and while the popular consensus about prohibition was that it was a bad idea, certainly that's the popular conception of my saloon keeper, it nevertheless was effective. It really did substantially reduce the consumption of alcohol, and of course there was a major cultural and political movement to do just that. But gradually, especially as we moved into the Depression, the drink became a matter of personal liberty, and it was repealed. There are, if you look at the amendments, there are two. In one way, they break down into two major categories. There are the first 10 amendments, which, as Adam alluded to, grant rights of or preserve rights of freedom of speech and religion and protections within the criminal process. The civil rights amendments, making it clear that we have equal protection of the law and privileges and immunities and due process, do much the same. And then there's a second category of amendments that deal with kind of recalibrations of the political process. limiting the number of terms that a president may have, providing for what would happen in the event of a vacancy in the vice presidency and so forth. One of the things that will be interesting to watch in this political process is where this amendment fits in that taxonomy. In one sense, however, I agree with Jeffrey that whether you see this as rights granting or rights limiting is largely reflective of how you see the underlying merits. But it is the type of amendment that is more of the foundational type, the definitional type, rather than the latter category of recalibration.
Adam, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Again, as we're discussing history, Jeffrey, what was really the most recent constitutional amendment that, obviously, they're proposed all the time, but which is the most recent that gained traction?
Well, I suppose the most recent one that passed or was formally recognized as part of the Constitution, oddly, was proposed at the time of the founding in the 1780s. It was the one prohibiting the salary of representatives or senators from being raised without an intervening election. Proposed at the time of the founding, not ratified until 1992 by a vote of Minnesota. The one before that was 1971, and that had to do with the right of citizens who are 18 years old to vote. And that was proposed and passed in only 4 months, so that happened very quickly. There's a very interesting dichotomy between the amendments that are proposed that have to deal with the structural holes that Doug Kamek was talking about and that are ratified quickly, and that tends to be the model in the late 20th century, and those that are controversial and languish. And the ERA is, of course, the model of that. Originally, there was a 7-year limitation passed by Congress, before which the amendment had to be ratified. There was a controversial extension, and it failed narrowly, partly because it was felt that the court decisions had granted the very right that the ERA was supposed to recognize, and therefore the amendment was unnecessary. The Child Labor Amendment was another one like that, proposed in the wake of conservative Supreme Court decisions, but the wind was taken out of the sails when the Supreme Court reversed itself in the 1930s, and it seemed to be unnecessary. So there's a very interesting and complicated convergence of judicial decisions and popular backlashes, and the amendments that pass and pass quickly tend to fill little holes that people can vote at 18 in the federal government, not in the states, rather than taking a side on a question that people are very divided about.
And I guess, Doug Kamek, the most recent one that seemed to be have a fair amount of wind behind its sails was the flag-burning amendment, which, as we've pointed out, did not get the momentum to get through Congress.
It did not, though it still has its supporters, and they periodically bring it back. But it was of a... I think one of the things with an issue like the flag-burning amendment, as intensely as people feel on one side or the other of that topic, is they feel it is so single-focused that it should be the subject of legislation rather than constitutional amendment. Of course, the difficulty is that the court has largely precluded most legislation, if not all legislation, on that topic. And that's what triggered the constitutional amendment process. You know, one interesting question, Neil, will be whether Congress puts a time limit on this amendment. The most recent experience, like with the Equal Rights Amendment, is to specify a time limit, but as Jeffrey mentioned, some have not had that time limit.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the Child Labor Amendment, which was proposed in 1926, was ratified by 28 states, and doesn't have an expiration date on it, so if there's 10 more states out there that want to ratify it, it can become part of the Constitution.
We're speaking with Doug Kamek of Pepperdine University and Jeffrey Rosen of George Washington University Law School. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now to get a sense of what the American public thinks about the issue of gay marriage and a constitutional amendment that might ban it, we've asked pollster Scott Keeter to join the discussion. He's Associate Director of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. He's here with us in Studio 3A. Welcome.
Hi. Nice to be here.
So what was the question you asked in polls on gay marriage? How did your survey group respond?
We have asked about gay marriage a number of times over the past year, and in almost every question that we've asked, we find roughly 2-to-1 majorities opposed to the idea of gay marriage. And our findings are very consistent with those of almost every polling organization. That's one question on which there is a consensus. On questions relating to civil unions, most polling organizations are finding roughly equal divisions on the question, but it depends a little bit on how you ask the question. However, on the question of constitutional amendment, it matters a lot how you ask the question, how you frame it, what the alternatives are that you present, and the like. questions that are asked that give people the option of saying, well, it should be left up to the state, typically find less than a majority in favor of a constitutional amendment. Those that simply present it as an up or down question tend to find either an equal division or, in some instances, a majority in favor.
So this is by no means a settled question in terms of the constitutional amendment.
Absolutely.
And obviously all of these polls taken before President Bush weighed in today.
Right.
And what about civil unions?
Well, civil unions are still a position that, in our polls, slightly less than a majority support. But it's interesting, if you look across a number of polls over the last few months, all of the components that go into civil union command majority support. So rights of inheritance, rights of adoption, and other...
Hospital visitation, all those sorts of things.
The legal incidents of marriage, if you will, all command sometimes small but sometimes large majorities. And so the package that would be put together in the form of civil unions is something that I think would command a majority support.
Is there broadly a way to measure public opinion, and I'm certainly hoping you've asked and tried, about issues of government regulating behavior, things like prohibition and like gay marriage?
Well, there have been a couple of interesting questions. We asked one in which we posed the question of whether people felt that the government should start up programs to encourage people to get married and stay married. And we found large majorities opposed to that. That is, commingling the government with marriage in the sense of it taking a position about it was something that people didn't like the idea of. ABC asked a similar kind of question. They also got a majority opposed to it.
So this is going to be a tricky political question, but if you ask it in terms of the political race, the presidential race, does this look like it might be a winning issue for President Bush?
Well, it has been described by a lot of people as the classic wedge issue, meaning that one side is united in its views on this. That is, most Republicans are opposed to gay marriage and most Republicans support a constitutional amendment, whereas Democrats are more divided. Both on the question of gay marriage in general and on the question of a constitutional amendment, although there are polls that show majorities of Democrats opposed to an amendment. The question is, on which side is it more important? If it's less important to the Democrats, then it's not an issue on which their candidates will suffer because they decide to go along with it.
Mm-hmm. Scott Keeter, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Scott Keeter, Associate Director of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. When we come back from a break, we'll continue with Doug Kamek and Jeffrey Rosen. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today on Talk of the Nation, we had scheduled the discussion on heroin addiction and the new younger users of the drug. Obviously, our plans changed when President Bush made his announcement earlier today backing a marriage amendment. So we'll talk about heroin addiction tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. In the meantime, here with us in Studio 3A is Jeffrey Rosen, Associate Professor at George Washington University Law School and Legal Affairs Editor of The New Republic. With us on the phone is Doug Kamek, Professor of Constitutional Law at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California, where I'm willing to wager the weather is a lot better than it is here in Washington. And this segment of the program, we want to hear a lot of your questions about this proposed constitutional amendment. And let's begin with Gene. Gene is with us from Indianapolis.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm wondering what the legal distinction between civil unions and marriage is.
Jeffrey Rosen, is there a legal distinction between civil union and marriage?
Very good question. I suppose the most obvious is that there's a different name. It's one is called a civil union, and the other is called a marriage, and for some people that means a lot, according to the polls. It's possible to convey almost all of the incidents of marriage on individuals for state law with the label civil unions, but it's not possible to convey federal benefits on individuals with civil unions because the Defense of Marriage Act, which was passed in the 1990s and signed by President Clinton, defines marriage for federal purposes as between a man and a woman. So right now, as long as civil unions are allowed to keep going up and running, if you have a civil union in Vermont, for example, you'd get all the benefits of marriage under Vermont state law, but you would not get federal marriage benefits.
Okay. Gene, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. you very much.
Okay. And here's a sort of on the same subject. This is an email from Eric. I see marriage as being a religious institution and that it should be regulated by religious institutions and not by government. Government should define something about being recognized as a unit for legal reasons and nothing else. Is anyone attempting to take this approach, in other words, getting the word marriage out of government? Doug Kamek?
Well, a few academic commentators have talked about it, but I don't think it's a serious political proposal. Most statutes, indeed all statutes in the states, allow, obviously, marriages to be performed by religious personnel, ministers, rabbis, priests, and so forth, but they premise their activity on the couple having already acquired from the relevant jurisdiction a license.
And indeed, they have to be married by a minister or rabbi or whichever official who's also licensed by the state.
I'm not sure that the state directly licenses them, but they acknowledge the ability of these religious officials to undertake their religious traditions, which, of course, would itself be protected by the Constitution.
Okay. If the Defense of Marriage Act is in place, and this is what President Bush was talking about earlier in his presidency, he said he didn't see the need for a constitutional amendment. So why now do you think, what is the argument, Doug Kamek, for saying we now do need a constitutional amendment?
Well, the president made it himself, and it's basically that he's distressed by the mayor here in San Francisco, who has taken it upon himself to disregard the express text of the California law and start issuing licenses to those who are, by the terms of that California law, not eligible. He's also distressed by the four justices in Massachusetts who applied a fairly aggressive form of constitutional theorizing to strike down the traditional definition of marriage in that jurisdiction. And he also sees it happening or beginning to happen in other places like New Mexico. And so this starts to oppose, I think, in the president's judgment, a major threat to an irreplaceable institution, and that only can be answered by hearing from the people directly, or their representatives in the form of a constitutional amendment, and coming up with a standard that we will all abide by.
It also, Jeffrey Rosen, raises the question of states are supposed to recognize what other states do. States may not want to recognize what, for example, Massachusetts may do on the question of marriage.
They may not, and there's a public policy exception that's traditionally allowed states to refuse to recognize marriages of which they disapprove. The Defense of Marriage Act codifies that. There's a question of whether that itself is constitutional, and that might be challenged. Right now, the most obvious difference between the federal amendment and the Defense of Marriage Act is the Defense of Marriage Act clearly allows for states to recognize civil unions if they choose, and allows for other states to recognize those unions, whereas the amendment that we've been discussing, at least according to one interpretation of it, might be construed to prohibit states from doing that. And in that sense, President Bush might be responding to the views of social conservatives who want neither marriage nor civil unions, and that's an important part of the debate as well.
Doug Kamek, as we mentioned earlier, I think something like 38 states have something like a Defense of Marriage Act in place. Obviously, one of them is California, where there's a big dispute going on. But in any case, does that suggest that if a marriage amendment did make it out of the House of Representatives and the Senate, that's a big if, but if it did, that they would probably go ahead and approve it? Or is there precedent to say, well, states sometimes don't see their legislation as being the same as, you know, they may not want the feds involved?
Well, you know, some people have said it's an oxymoron to say that a federal constitutional amendment should deal with marriage, because marriage has always been a state subject and a local subject, and it's contrary to principles of states' rights and federalism. The counterpoint would be that the amendment process is itself respectful of federalism insofar as you just mentioned, it requires obviously great approval of three-fourths of the states before anything becomes federal law. I think the rather rapid passage of Defense of Marriage Acts in the states indicates that this is an amendment, if worded carefully. And I think it has to be worded in a way that takes account of the empirical findings your researcher had reported before the break,
mm-hmm.
If worded carefully, will get fairly substantial support and quickly. But the difficulty, Neil, is always those last few states. And so getting 30 may well be within reach, getting those last eight, even though we have defensive marriage acts in all 38, seems to me to be more questionable just by virtue of the political process.
Which raises this email question we have from Michael in San Francisco. In light of President Bush's directive to quickly push this constitutional amendment through to the states, how quickly could this actually get through to a vote by the states? Will an amendment have to address the disparity in rights allowed to couples who are married as opposed to those joined by civil union? Jeffrey Rosen?
I guess it could go as quickly as the states want to ratify it. I gather that the last amendment, the 18-year-old vote amendment, passed in 1971, was ratified months after it was proposed. So it could go racing out, but for the reasons Doug Kamek suggests, that may not well be the case. Does an amendment have to talk about the disparity between civil unions and marriage? No. It can say whatever it likes and becomes part of the Constitution by virtue of its ratification. So an amendment is uniquely unconstrained by existing constitutional norms. It has to be integrated into the previous document, but it can transform it as well, and that's why it's our highest form of constitutional lawmaking, obviously.
And Doug Kamek, in other systems, you do have sort of you have to take a second thought. You've got to pass this bill twice, and in some states, pass the proposed amendment twice and then have it ratified by a popular vote. The hurdle here is, as you say, it can be done quickly. The hurdle here is that it has to be done by overwhelming majorities in both houses of Congress and then three-quarters of the states.
Yes, those are the specifications in the federal Constitution, and Neil, I would suggest those are the ones that govern. The fact that there are local rules in state constitutions for how you amend the state constitution, and what you just alluded to is how you amend the Massachusetts Constitution, those may well be irrelevant to the amendment process for the federal Constitution. Congress largely gets to set any of the rules that are left undefined in the text on this question, but I would think majorities of the legislature in all the states is all that you need to get state approval.
We're speaking with Doug Kamek and Jeffrey Rosen. The issue is a proposed amendment. The President of the United States said today he thought it would be a good idea to define marriage as being between a man and a woman, husband and wife. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Carrie. And Carrie's on the line with us from Stockton, California.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I was actually, I'm a same-sex relationship, so this is very close to my heart. And I was curious, I've always thought that if a case actually went to the U.S. Supreme Court fighting for same-sex marriage, that it would be granted, hopefully would be granted if it were under a previous amendment granting equal access under the law. My question is, if this amendment, this current idea were to pass, how do we deal with contradictions in amendments? Because to me, there's a big contradiction between, you know, banning same-sex marriage to people and then in a previous amendment having equal access under the law that's not equal access. And which would supersede and how would that go?
I think lawyers would get rich, but Jeffrey Rosen, why don't you cash in first?
Lawyers and law professors, because that's the best question you can ask in constitutional law. The question of how to integrate an amendment that comes after with the one that comes before is the one that really gets us going. And we've faced it before, of course. What happened after the 19th Amendment granted women the right to vote? Narrowly, it was just granting a political right, but it was construed in future cases to guarantee a broader sense of women's equality that included civil rights and rights in the workplace as well. So that was an example of the Supreme Court recognizing a constitutional value and broadening it, integrating it with the previous regime. What's so interesting about your question, of course, is what do you do when you have one, a constitutional principle, the promise of equal protection, and another one which, at least in the views of some people, clashes with that, and basically the court would have to make sense of the two as best it could, but I don't think there's any question that it would nullify the amendment. It would have to recognize marriages as between a man and a woman, and then that would just have to be viewed as an exception to the broader promise of equality.
Doug Kamek, did you want to weigh in on this?
I think Jeffrey's got it right. I think we've got another example where the issue of state sovereignty was affected by the passage of the 14th Amendment. States have certain immunity from suit by virtue of the previous 11th Amendment, but the Supreme Court has said Congress has power by virtue of the later in time 14th Amendment to invade some of that sovereign space of the states, even as Congress lacks that power under original provisions of the Constitution that predated. So chronology can be important as well.
Carrie, good question.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Here's an email question from Michael Oliver in Miami Beach. Will his support for a gay marriage ban make George Bush the first president to back a constitutional amendment that reduces the rights of citizens rather than granting the rights to citizens? And Jeffrey Rosen said earlier, I think, that it depends on how you want to look at that. Right, Doug Kamek?
I think it is. One person's right is another person's subtraction of that. I think the way President Bush sees the matter is that, as we've talked before, that marriage is irreplaceable, that that in fact there's a particular benefit that the governance of Republican institutions, Republican Democratic institutions get from having strong families, and the president sees that as bound up with the definition of traditional marriage.
Here's another email question from Bobby in Portland, Oregon. What's the legal definition of man and woman when a constitutional amendment required genetic testing in order to get a marriage license? Jeffrey?
What a good question. I think I'm stumped on that one. The legal definition of man and woman, Doug, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know of any in any statute, but... I suppose that if marriage is defined as between a man and a woman, it would indeed become legally relevant whether you are a man or a woman. And someone who is a transgender person might presumably say that they're belong to one category or another, and perhaps the courts or statutes would have to decide how you qualified. So there's yet another wrinkle, and a very interesting one.
And with the addition of two words, they could take care of that old polygamy question by saying one man and one woman. So anyway, let's get one final call in if we have time. A Wink is with us from Portland, Oregon.
Yes, hello. I was wondering if the Constitution says anything about marriage at all right now.
Dr. Kamek?
It doesn't, although the Supreme Court has construed the word liberty to include the fundamental right to marry and have treated it on a par with other fundamental rights such as the right of speech and freedom of religion.
Wink, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And thanks to our constitutional experts for being with us today and what may be the first of a series of discussions if this amendment does indeed make it through both houses of Congress and then move on to legislatures in the states, where, again, it would have to be approved by three quarters. And obviously there's going to be more coverage of this issue later today on All Things Considered, so stay tuned for that. Doug Kamek, always good to speak with you.
Neil, good to be with you.
Doug Kamek is a professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California, co-author of Individual Rights and the American Constitution. Jeffrey Rosen was with us here in Studio 3A, and also nice to have you with us in the studio this time.
Very nice to be here.
Jeffrey Rosen, associate professor at George Washington University Law School, legal affairs editor at The New Republic, and author of The Naked Crowd. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.